Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How do patterns from nature apply to human innovation? It turns out the most fertile environments for conceiving and incubating good ideas tend to have much in common with places in the natural world that nurture biological diversity. So if we understand those relationships, can we create conditions that stimulate really productive ways of thinking? Writer Stephen Johnson is a contributing editor to Wired magazine. He explores these questions in his latest book, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. Stephen, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So you open the book with this really cool story about Charles Darwin exploring this coral reef not far from Sumatra. And at first, he's really baffled because there's not much going on land, but there's everything going on underwater.
Yeah, this is this paradox that we now actually call Darwin's paradox, which is that coral reefs are effectively the cities of the sea, right? They have an amazing amount of kind of the marine biodiversity in the entire oceans are concentrated in these relatively small bits of the ocean. Something like a quarter of marine species live in coral reefs when they actually take up less than 1% of the kind of land mass. And so there's this question about why they're able to do this. And in fact, Darwin has these kind of memories of kind of paddling out and kind of swimming around in this amazing biodiversity and looking at it. And then he walks onto the land, as you said, and he looks around and there's like a couple of trees and a rat that some European ship has left there. There's basically nothing interesting happening above sea level, but below sea level, there's this incredible underwater metropolis. And the funny thing about this is that the waters around there are remarkably nutrient poor. They actually shouldn't support as much life as they do. And yet there's something about that ecosystem that enables it to create this amazing amount of kind of biological innovation. And that was a riddle for a long period of time, trying to figure out why they were so good at this. And it turns out that really what's driving the coral reef ecosystem is the way that the organisms there cooperate, and the way that they are able to kind of build on each other's, in some cases, their waste, kind of recycling the waste produced by other organisms. The coral polyp itself, which is, of course, so central to the coral reef, leaves behind the skeleton that then becomes home to thousands of other creatures and creates these effectively little underwater apartment buildings. And so they basically take very little, but because of the way that they kind of collaborate and share resources and share each other's kind of creations, they're able to build this amazing environment.
And the more that is there, the more that is attracted to the area because of that symbiosis.
That's right. Exactly.
And so as it turns out, this has an almost direct relationship to the creative habitats that are seen in really burgeoning cities. And we don't want to be down on rural areas. But the more people you have doing more things, the more you create.
Well, rural areas contribute a huge amount to society on lots of different levels. But if you look at the history of innovation and the history of the creative arts, I think most of us recognize intuitively that urban areas kind of lead the way in terms of innovative ideas and creative innovations. And scientifically, actually, there was a wonderful study done a few years ago led by Jeffrey West, who used to run the Santa Fe Institute. And he with a bunch of other people, he looked at all these kind of patterns and data points in cities all around the world. He was measuring a bunch of different things, but one of the things he was measuring was basically how creative a given city was. And so he's measuring it by both the number of kind of arts organizations, but also the number of patents and kind of startups and things like that. And he had about six or seven different kind of major data points for this. And he compared the kind of rate of innovation to the overall population size of the city. And what he found was that as cities grew bigger, they grew disproportionately more innovative, right? It wasn't just that a city that was 10 times bigger than another city was 10 times more innovative. It was actually 30 times more innovative. And so there was something there about the city as it grows larger, as it grows more kind of densely populated, something kind of gets triggered by that process that makes the people inside that city think in a more innovative way. And this runs to some extent counter to our assumptions about how to have good ideas, right? We often hear like, okay, if you want to have good ideas and think in an interesting way about the world, you should really focus and get yourself into a quiet space and not be distracted by things. If distraction is the enemy of good, interesting thought, right? But cities, of course, are incredibly distracting places, right? They're filled with all these people and, you know, noise and chaos and tumult and people colliding next to you on the sidewalk and traffic jams and all these things that people deplore in cities. And yet somehow, despite that chaos, they manage to generate all this interesting thinking at the same time. And so in some ways, the argument of this book is that it's not despite the chaos. It's, in fact, because of the chaos. It's because of all those collisions and interesting overlaps and the density of a big city that we do have such a history of innovation in these spaces.
So you cite Stuart Kaufman here, who did a lot of research into this thing that he called the adjacent possible. Tell us what that is.
Yeah, you know, the adjacent possible is one of those concepts that I first read about in Stuart's book 10 years ago, and I've been trying to figure out a way to work into one of my books because it's a beautiful idea and it's quite simple in some ways. The concept is that at any given point in the history of kind of evolution and in the history of human society, there's a kind of a finite set of moves that you can make, or that the system can make, or the society can make, given the limitations of biological life at that point or technological, intellectual life.
It's where you start, essentially.
It's where you start, right. So I mean, a good metaphor is a chess game. When you're in the middle of a chess game, there's a set of moves that you can make, and then there's a much larger set of moves that you can't make, given where the pieces are and on the playing board. And so the adjacent possible of a chess game is that set of moves that you can make at that particular moment. And the idea is that when you're inside a society and you're trying to figure out how to innovate and push it forward in a new direction, there are opportunities at every point. There are new things that you can do given the existing technology or the existing thoughts. But there's also limitations, right? On some fundamental level, you cannot invent a microwave oven in 1650, right? There are too many steps that separate you from that kind of understanding. And so you have to work within the kind of boundaries of thought at a given time. And so in the book, I kind of set this out in this opening chapter to say that when we think about how innovation works, when we think about how creativity works, what you're fundamentally doing is exploring the adjacent possible of your life or your moment in time. And if you go too far, I mean, a great example is Charles Babbage, who in the middle of the 19th century effectively invented the programmable computer, collaborating with Ada Lovelace, Lord Byron's daughter, who was the world's first software programmer, which is a wonderful little tidbit that most people don't know about the history of programming.
But they were literally ahead of their time.
They were so far ahead of his time. He came up with the idea of having a central processing unit, of having RAM, of having software that would be kind of read from RAM into the CPU and execute commands inside the CPU. All of these things are – every single computer in the world basically follows this logic. But he was trying to build a digital age computer with industrial era parts. This was going to be a steam-powered kind of mechanical contraption, and it just couldn't be done. The ideas were brilliant, but it couldn't be done given the adjacent possible of 19th century England. And it was so far ahead of its time that the ideas actually kind of died out, and they had to be independently rediscovered almost 100 years later when in the 30s and the 40s people actually started to build computers because they had access to things like vacuum tubes, which Babbage didn't.
It is one of those lessons that you should never discard an idea you have, even if you can't figure out in the moment how to make it work.
Right. Well, that's one of the things that the book is trying to challenge is the conventional idea of the eureka moment when, you know, you're sitting there and the apple falls from the tree and suddenly you have a theory of gravity. You know, we like to tell stories of innovation in these, you know, moments of sudden clarity and epiphany and things like that. But the truth is that almost all the great ideas that I've looked at have a much slower and more evolutionary kind of history to them, that they start as kind of a hunch in the back of somebody's mind, a feeling that there's an interesting avenue to explore, and really an intuition about something. And then they linger in that state for long periods of time. And sometimes they linger, in some cases, for decades. And then it's not until you kind of stumble across somebody else who has this missing piece to the puzzle, or the technology around you changes, or something in your own perspective on the world changes, and suddenly things start to look a little bit different and you can make use of this. You know, a great example of that is Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the World Wide Web. he started this as a side project when he was basically working as a temp in this physics lab in Switzerland.
And he doesn't really remember thinking, oh my gosh, we should have the World Wide Web.
Yeah. He deliberately was not setting out to invent the World Wide Web. He was trying to solve a very kind of local problem where he was at this complicated lab and there were a lot of projects and people, and he was trying to create a little tool that would help him organize that in software. And he worked on that for a while, and then he worked on a slightly different version of it. And then about 5 or 6 years later, he started working on a kind of the third model, which was the only one this was the one he started calling the web. He didn't even call the first couple ones the web. And he borrowed some existing technology and kind of software standards for describing how the pages would be laid out. And at that point, he started to think, maybe I've got something interesting here. And it was only then that he went to his bosses to say, hey, I think I may have invented the most important global medium. It was only then that he realized he was really onto something big. And even then, had no idea what it was really going to turn into. But and I think the part of the point, as you say, is that if Berners-Lee had set out in 1982, to invent the World Wide Web, it would have never happened because it was too ambitious. And it was only because he had an environment that allowed him to follow this slow hunch, as I call it in the book, this kind of lingering hunch in the background, and to tinker with it for long periods of time, that he was able to ultimately make such a transformative invention.
And it only became what it is today because literally billions of people have played a role in filling it out.
Yeah, well, there are two sides to that. The first is one of the crucial things about the origins of the World Wide Web is that Tim Berners-Lee didn't have to invent the internet first, right? The web is a platform that sits on top of the internet. Mm-hmm. And it sits on top of a bunch of other standards that had been built over the preceding 10 or 20 years by thousands of scientists all over the world, computer scientists. And if he had actually had to build a global communications platform and all the routers that talk to each other and all that stuff, it would have never happened because that was way too much for one person to do. But because the internet was an open platform where someone could come along and say, hey, I want to build something on top of this, and because he didn't have to ask for permission and he didn't have to go and do a business development deal and have his lawyers to talk to somebody else's lawyers, he could just do it because it was a free, open environment. He was able to build this amazing thing. And the reason that the web then has subsequently been so innovative, and in some ways in the book, the opening chapter is Reef City Web. I mean, the web is like the cities and the coral reefs. It's been an unbelievable space of innovation in a very short amount of time. And the reason the web has been like that is that it, too, has those properties that the internet had, which is that anyone can come along and build stuff on top of it, and they don't have to ask for permission. And because it's an agreed-upon set of standards where people are free to kind of improve on and connect to other people's ideas, the environment has been able to kind of reinvent itself in so many different ways in such a short amount of time. Now, it's also true that one thing that has encouraged people to do that is because every now and then one of them makes $5 billion doing it, right? So there are the Sergey and Larry from Google and Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook and folks who've, in their 20s made more money than you and I can even imagine. But part of the point of this book is that that's not the only reason. It's not just the economic reward. It's the fact that the environment, the platform was open and connective and allowed these people to create without having to ask for permission.
Stephen Johnson is my guest. His new book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
I'm Chris. Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Stephen Johnson. He is a contributing editor to Wired magazine and author of the new book, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. So, Stephen, I want to go back to nature for a minute and talk about exaptation, which is just the coolest thing. Like, feathers evolved to regulate temperature.
Right. And yet, it turned out that the organisms that had these feathers, that were basically just a nice little down jacket for them, keeping them warm, some of these creatures decided to adopt this new lifestyle of flying, and it turned out the ones that had feathers were a little better at it than the ones who didn't have feathers. And so at that point, natural selection began to kind of have this kind of different relationship to feathers, where feathers started to get sculpted to be asymmetrical, which, for reasons that I don't totally understand, makes them more aerodynamic. They have better lift, basically, if they're asymmetrical. So non-flying birds, even today, have very symmetrical feathers, whereas birds that fly have asymmetrical feathers, right? And so this is a pattern that recurs throughout the history of evolution. And Stephen Jay Gould and Elizabeth Verba, a number of years ago, in a very influential paper, came up with this term for this, which they called exaptation, which is a somewhat awkward word, but it's such a powerful concept that I just had to give one of my chapters that name. And the idea is that basically, while it's true that we sometimes get innovation in biology from just random genetic mutations and things like that, a lot of important breakthroughs come from a feature or a trait that was originally sculpted kind of for one purpose. It turns out to have some unexpected use in another field, particularly when the environment changes, right? When you go from walking around on your feet to trying to move through the air, certain features have different properties. And Gould and Verba's point was this is actually a main driver, one of the main drivers of innovation in the biological record. So what I'm trying to argue in this book is that it's maybe even more prevalent in cultural evolution and in the history of technology or in science or in the arts, where you have these concepts or tools or ways of creating art or kind of devices, literary devices and genres and things like that, that were originally designed by their creators to do one thing, and it turns out they're good for something completely different.
My favorite example of this is the fact that wine is the reason that we know Gutenberg's name all these hundreds of years later.
You're right. So Gutenberg, I mean, you know, brilliant guy. He's working on his movable type. He does amazing kind of pioneering work as a metallurgist, you know, creating these typefaces. And he also does interesting work with inks. That was a big part of what he was doing. But he didn't actually have a printing press mechanism, right? He had the type, but he didn't have something to press the type onto the page, which is...
It was still done manually.
And so that's a big part of the invention. And so he's kind of stuck. And it turns out that he goes up, it's a wine harvesting season, and so he goes up into the hills of Rhineland, Germany, to drink a bunch of wine, I guess, which is another way of having a good idea.
This was not a fact-finding mission.
Yeah, he was just like, I'm stuck. I got to go booze it up for a while. And so he's up there, and he sees this ancient technology of the screw press, which had been around for thousands of years, which these Rhineland vintners were using to press grapes. And he looks at this thing, and he says, that's what I'm missing. And so he borrows this, you know, ancient screw press, kind of takes it and exaps it, to use Gould's language, kind of rejiggers it so that it actually can work with type instead of grapes. And he uses it to print Bibles instead of make wine.
The other great thing about that story is it points to the fact that, you know, we can get so focused on the task at hand and surround ourselves with other people who are doing exactly the same kind of work. And as brilliant as they are, sometimes we all get this sort of groupthink, as opposed to that cross-pollination that comes from, you know, being a computer programmer who hangs out with musicians and chefs on the weekend.
Well, there's a study that I talk about in the book by a guy named Martin Roif, who's at Stanford Business School. And what Roif did was he went and looked at people in the corporate world who were unusually innovative in their jobs and compared them to people who, to put it gently, were not so innovative in their jobs, which is not the part of the experiment you want to be asked to participate in. Like, you seem very dull.
Here at the control
room, yeah. Can we ask you? And what he wanted to look at was, you know, are there any noticeable differences between the social networks of these two different groups? Social networks meaning not Facebook and Twitter, but who they actually knew in real life and things. And what he found was that there was a very distinct kind of signature pattern in the innovators. And the innovators were much more likely to be friends with or kind of weak tie acquaintances with people who occupied, you know, a diverse range of professions. So if you were a marketing person in an ad agency, you were unusually innovative, you were more likely to know an architect and a plumber and a poet and a popular science writer and a government contract, you know, lawyer and so on. Whereas the less innovative people just knew a lot of marketing people at other ad agencies, basically. And so in some sense, you know, what's driving that, I think, is precisely this idea of acceptation. It's because you go and you have drinks with your architect friend and he says something interesting about a project he's working on, and something in it, because it's different from your normal routine, exactly as you said, triggers this new association in your head, or that hunch you've been working on for a while, suddenly, because you're talking to your friend, the lawyer, and they say something about the case they're arguing that just makes you think about the problem in a new way. And you get outside of your normal kind of zone of comfort and familiarity, and an interesting new network of an idea forms in your mind from this collision of perspectives. And so I think where that takes you to is that this is effectively the non-political argument for diversity, right? It's not just that, and I think this is perfectly true, but it's not just that it's good for us as a society to be more tolerant of different backgrounds and to experience different perspectives on the world. It also, on some level, makes us smarter, right? It makes us more original in our thinking because we are encountering these things. So I think it's a good mantra for people to have, to just kind of keep their social networks diverse and not get locked into those kind of echo chambers.
It's also, I guess, a reminder to stay open to things, because it's one thing to hear something that is revolutionary, but so many times we're so focused on something else that we don't really pay attention to it.
One of the things that I realized after I'd written a lot of this book and also the last two books that I wrote, The Ghost Map and The Invention of Error, which are both kind of long-form studies of breakthrough ideas and the people and the environments that made them possible, that the heroes of both those books and then a bunch of the people in this book, they all have this recurring quality, which is that they have a lot of hobbies. Like they're constantly getting into weird other subjects that aren't actually their main focus. Darwin is a great example. Darwin was just obsessed with the main thing. So he'd be working on his big idea of natural selection, but then he'd be like, now I must go tend to my barnacles, you know, or whatever. And Jon Snow, one of the two heroes of The Ghost Map, which was about a cholera epidemic and how Snow was able to solve this mystery of where the cholera was coming from. Cholera was his hobby. His day job was as a physician and an anesthesiologist, but he was interested in this medical mystery of where the cholera was coming from. And most of us don't consider cholera to be a hobby.
Thank God.
It kind of throws people off at the cocktail parties when you mention that. But it really was for him. And so in a sense, what that does is, you want to keep your social networks diverse, but it almost gives you a diverse social network in your own brain, because you're constantly bouncing back and forth between these different projects.
Stephen Johnson is my guest. His new book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. It's where we find Jim in Carrollton. Hey, Jim.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
You know, one of the things that I have noticed is that most new ideas and innovations come from liberals. And there's a good reason for that. Conservatives tend to rely on the tried and true, and they like things to be certain. Since cities, you had mentioned that cities are places where a lot of this is a hotbed. Is that because liberals tend to congregate in cities?
That is, you know, I've been on book tour for 14 days now. No one has ever asked me that question, so give that man a prize.
Kudos to you, Jim. Thank you.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I guess I would say that it is probably that there is a connection there. I don't want to get too political about it, but I would say that there's a connection there in precisely because of the diversity point, right? So cities force you – one of the reasons why cities are innovative is that they force you to hang out and share space with people who are fundamentally different from you. That is both the great charm and sometimes the annoyance of the city, when it's an incredibly sweaty, overweight person who's on the elevator with you going up to your apartment and you don't want to be that close, or on the subway with someone. Economists have often talked about this in terms of cities, where they talk about this category that they call information spillover. When people are kind of crowded together, there's this natural tendency of an idea to jump from one person's mind to the other, just because they're next to each other. And even if they're trying to keep their ideas secret, they they spill over, and there's a kind of fluidity to the space. And so there is a kind of an interest in and a productive relationship to diversity that happens in terms of innovation. And I think, you know, certainly one of the attributes of the liberal kind of political worldview is embracing diversity, making diversity a real kind of goal for the society, and saying that, you know, diversity is more important, say, in some cases than tradition and then stability. It's better to have a complex melting pot with lots of different perspectives. That's one of the definitions of the word liberal, is open to kind of different perspectives. And so that those two things would come together in the space of cities, and there would generally be a tendency of cities to be more liberal, does make a lot of sense. In fact, one of the single most reliable predictors of a nation's political place on the spectrum is how urban it is, right? You know, Holland, for instance, the Netherlands, is the most urbanized country in the world, which is very small, but it's densely populated by people living in cities, and it is about as left-wing as you can get as a country. And so I think that there probably is a connection there.
So is that an argument against concentrating a particular industry that wants to be innovative in one region? I'm thinking right now, there's two examples, and one seems quite successful and the other one not so much. You know, Detroit's had so many problems, and there are a variety of reasons for that. You've got lots of big companies, people working for the same industry, maybe for different employers. But then you have Silicon Valley, and that seems to be a place where great ideas are springing forth?
Well, I think it's a really good question. And I haven't thought about it that much, so I'm kind of improvising this response here. But I think you're probably right. There probably is an early advantage that comes from consolidation, because when you have a field that's being invented from scratch, right, there's a lot of value that you get from being close to each other, because everything you're doing is new, right? Mm-hmm. You're kind of figuring out how to build automobiles and how to build an assembly line and all that kind of stuff. And your rival down the street comes up with a new kind of way to organize the assembly line, and you can say, wow, okay, we're going to do that too. So there's a lot of information spillover that can happen that can benefit you, because everything you're doing is new. And I think what happens probably where that starts to be a problem is when the industry matures, and then it starts to kind of ossify, or it starts to just get stuck in its ways, and it doesn't have these kind of outside forces pushing it in new directions. One way to say that is to say, okay, well, Silicon Valley was still pretty new, and it's still relatively kind of immature as a space. It's only been around for 40 years or something like that. But I think the other thing is that for some reasons that we've talked about already, the rate of change in the digital world is so much faster than it is in the automobile world. I mean, you could travel back in time with a car from today and show it to somebody, you know, as the Ford Model Ts were coming off the assembly line, and they would say, that's a car, I know what that is.
You're still getting from point A to point B.
Yeah, whereas if you showed somebody, you know, an iPhone and said, yeah, it uses GPS to navigate, here, look at this map, and show that to somebody in 1965 in Silicon Valley, they'd be like, what is that? I don't even know what that is. Computers are the size of a room. What are you talking about? You know, and so there's a bit more of kind of constant change going on in Silicon Valley, and new possibilities are always kind of erupting. And so I think that space just is by definition a little bit more chaotic, and it's almost like there are multiple industries there, because you have people who are still making chips, and then you have people who are making social network software. And those two things are just massively different from each other, and in some ways different from people who make cars.
I was surprised to read, Stephen, that there is a fairly predictable cycle of time that passes between the sort of spark of a great idea to the execution, and then once again to the point where it's really widely adopted. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, in consumer technology through the 20th century, I think we do have this idea that it's been continuously accelerating, that things are happening faster. But actually, it's not entirely true. When you go back and look at the last 100 years, you look at the introduction of the telephone, the radio, the television, the VCR, cell phones, personal computers, all these kind of big milestone consumer technology products. They actually follow this pretty reliable pattern, which I call kind of the 10-10 rule, which is that they take about 10 years to, you know, you have the first working prototype to the first shipping product. And then about 10 years from that first shipping product to it becoming a real mainstream, you know, roughly 50% of the population using it. And there's a little variation, obviously, but basically that's the pattern that you see. You know, the first personal computers, you know, are built in the mid-70s, and they don't really, you know, it takes about 10 years of kind of tinkering with it, but they don't really become kind of mainstream until the late 80s and so on. So the thing that I find interesting about this is that the web has broken all that that pattern. And you look at something like YouTube, which fundamentally changed the way that the web worked. I mean, there really wasn't video on the web before YouTube came along. It was not a medium that supported video in a kind of reliable way. And YouTube introduced a bunch of different innovations. One, just making video a mainstream thing on the web. But two, the ability to share it and to kind of put a video clip on your own site effortlessly, which is a big part of why it took off, is people were putting in their own clips on their own, kind of programming their own kind of little, you know, TV networks on their own blogs. And that idea took about a year and a half to build, and it took about a year and a half to 2 years to become one of the 10 largest sites on the internet. So they took the 10-10 rule and made it, you know, 1-1 or 2-2, depending on how you measure it. And so there's something about, again, this gets to this point of the web, there's something about that space that enables these ideas to both be generated and then to circulate and become adopted by people much, much faster than before.
Stephen Johnson is my guest. His new book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, languages, history, and communication start weekly in January. Details at smu.edu/think.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Johnson. He's a contributing editor to Wired magazine and author of the new book, Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. So, Stephen, going back to the question of YouTube, everybody loves it, but last time I checked, they haven't really been able to monetize this thing that is an everyday experience for so many people. Certainly for my kids, they go to YouTube before they go to TV.
Well, we don't fully know. I mean, Google has bought YouTube, bought it a few years ago for some enormous amount of billions of dollars. And there is a lot of debate about. There was actually an interesting Malcolm Gladwell article where he talked about how the speculation was they were losing a lot of money. Google has said, well, they don't really break it out. They say that it is, you know, it is doing better economically than people think it is. So, it is a kind of unique thing in that video file sizes are just so large that it takes a lot to transmit it. And so, it may be something where they have to, it has to mature for kind of a longer period of time. My sense is that Google thinks in the long run it will be a very important asset for them, and that they will ultimately have it be profitable if it isn't already today.
So let's talk about creating these cultures where innovation happens. We've all been to those corporate retreats, you know, where you play games and you pass around a roll of toilet paper and you wear
balls.
A silly hat. Exactly. And they're sometimes, most people dread them, then you kind of have a good time when you're there. And then you go back and you sit in your cubicle and you do things the same way you did before.
Yeah, I think that those things are great for morale, right? I mean, I've nothing against the corporate retreat, that can be nice for people to hang out in a different context. I don't think they do a lot for innovation in the organization. And the problem is that it's, you know, it's one day out of the year. And the likelihood that you're going to have, you know, that interesting hunch and be sitting across the table during the brainstorming session with someone else who has the other missing piece of the hunch at that particular moment in time is very slim. I think a much more interesting approach is to create a work environment where that more open-ended, exploratory, kind of hunch-cultivating space is something that's kind of running all the time in the background. It doesn't have – you obviously can't – people have to get stuff done,
yeah.
Right? You know, they can't just come into work and say, I'm working on my hunch. But Google, actually, we're talking about Google. Google, modeled after something that 3M did, has a very interesting program which they call 20% time or innovation time off. And the idea is that engineers at Google are encouraged to spend 20% of their time, basically one day a week, working on whatever they want, working on their own little private hunch for some project. And all it has to be is something that is vaguely related to the general kind of corporate mandates for the company, which in Google's case is organizing all the world's information, which is a pretty open definition. You can pretty much fit, you know, organizing my Dungeons and Dragons collection fits under here. So what they require is that people report, you know, progress on their project or the status update to their superiors like once a month, basically. And what Google finds is that they get something like 50% of their, you know, actual shipping new features and products come out of the 20% time of innovation time off. So parts of Gmail, parts of AdSense, which is crucial to their business, Google News, big products that people know a lot about, came out of that hunch space that they've carved out. And I think that's the kind of balancing act you want to create in your organization is to allow people that freedom to cultivate these ideas, but not surrender the entire, you know, work week over to them.
Well, it's so interesting, the idea of letting the mind wander and the fact that there's value to that. And this is different from the, you know, trying to type an email while you're making a phone call, while you're, you know, adding something up. I guess people don't have adding machines anymore.
Yes.
I'm trying to imagine a world outside my own office. But it is funny, you know, having worked always for media organizations, I've never dealt with, you know, not being allowed to use certain websites when I'm at work. But there are a lot of places where, you know, there are restrictions placed on people's ability to let their minds wander because corporations are worried about productivity being affected.
Yeah. I, you know, one of the things that I get a great deal of kind of inspiration from is ironically from Twitter, which people make fun of for being, you know, the 140 characters about what some random person had for breakfast.
Yeah.
That's the kind of reputation it has. But what Twitter turns out to be really good at, and here's a case of kind of acceptation. This is something that it wasn't originally designed to do. But one of the things that people do on Twitter is that they pass around links to interesting things that they've read that day, whether it's a New York Times article or a NPR segment that's online or a blog post from someone. And while it's 140 characters, you just put a link there and you go and you read the 4,000-word article or you read the, you know, longer blog post. So it's not limited by the restrictions of 140 characters. And if you assemble, back to our point about diversity, if you assemble an interesting mix of people to follow on Twitter, and so if you're following a couple of musicians and you're following a couple of tech pundits and you're following a couple of friends and you're following an architect and you're following interesting people, and you each morning sit down to read the things that they're reading and the things that they found interesting enough to kind of throw up onto Twitter to share, that creates a really interesting little kind of daily media diet that is kind of collectively curated by the people that you follow, most of whom probably don't know each other and have no idea that they're, you know, sharing space in your Twitter feed. And I now get, you know, I would say more than half of my kind of daily intake of new things to read come from the people that I follow on Twitter. And I find it to be just really always really interesting and surprising and stimulating. And it helps me keep up with what people are talking about in a really kind of active way. I mean, I know when I see four people pointing to the same story, I'm like, okay, this story is being talked about.
It matters,
this is interesting,
yeah.
You know. And so it helps me figure out what to read, is, you know, and not just, you know, shoving an endless amount of stuff down the transom. And so I think, you know, it's not that you want your employees to spend all day reading their Twitter feeds, but to the extent that that is part of what they can get out of the web, I think in kind of reasonable doses that to not do that is going to limit their originality, limit their kind of awareness of other ideas and the kind of creative way that they think on the job.
Let's go next to Bill in Dallas. Hey, Bill.
Hey, this is Bill in Dallas. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I've got a question for Stephen. Earlier talking about computer technology, and while I was in California a couple of years ago, on a Saturday morning, I turned into a, for lack of a better word, a techno geek discussion on storage capacities and things that were coming down the road. And they were talking about the invention of a metallic paper-like substance that would record data in colors, you know, the 256 colors or whatever it was, and it was capable of lasting 100 years and one sheet of paper would do the Library of Congress, you know, stuff like that. And I was just wondering if any of these products actually ever make it out and if he's actually heard of this continuing on in a in a timely frame or if it's actually going to occur. And I'm getting ready to run out of cell service, so I'll just go back and listen to the program. Thank
All right.
you.
Thanks, Bill.
I don't know that exact product, but it's funny. I was just in New York last night doing an event at the New York Public Library there with a wonderful writer who's kind of one of my heroes named Kevin Kelly, who has a book out as of yesterday called What Technology Wants, which I'm just going to plug for Kevin.
You tweeted.
I'm tired of talking about my book. And so we were talking about, you know, where technology is heading. And Kevin was making the point that the storage technology is advancing so fast that, you know, within 2 years, based on his calculations of what's out there and where we're headed, you will be able to have on a device that fits in your pocket the digital text of every book ever written. Now that is, I mean, when we first had iPods and we were like, okay, 10,000 songs in your pocket, that's really amazing. But the idea of the entire history of, you know, books in your pocket. And on some level, it's amazing. But the problem is, as Kevin said, is that the next question is, okay, what do I do with this? You know, like, what do I read? That's a lot of books in my pocket. I can't possibly. I would spend the rest of my life reading all these books. But it shows you how, I mean, I remember when they came out with the first Next computer, which was Steve Jobs' kind of company in between his stints at Apple, which became the basis for Mac OS X, one of the things that it shipped with was the complete works of Shakespeare. And I was in college then, and I was just blown away at the idea that you would have, you know, on your hard drive.
And it's
you
free.
Would have, you know,
yeah.
And it was right there, and they could store the whole thing on one hard drive. That was incredible. And now it's like every book ever written is going to fit in your pocket.
Yeah, it is, you know, the same thing with the iPod. You think, I remember having to carry, like, CDs to travel or something, and you have that bulky player.
Yeah.
I want to talk about this, though. There's this idea sometimes when we get a good idea. It reminds me of seventh grade where you hunch over your paper and you don't want anyone to copy what you're trying to do. We all think we need a protect these, and there are all these patent laws, and people have a right, obviously, to profit from their innovation, but we might actually be hurting ourselves if we keep it under our hands?
Well, what I'm trying to argue in this book is that we need to have a slightly better balance, and just in terms of the ways we think about what encourages innovation, we need to just be a little bit broader in our understanding. So it is true that, as I said before, one of the things that encourages innovation is the idea that you may become rich if your idea takes off. And that understandably pushes people to try and keep their ideas secret until they're released into the world, and to lock them up in private, you know, trade secrets and proprietary technology and so on. But the problem is, from a social perspective, what we're really interested in is not making people rich. We're interested in having good ideas spread and be adopted and creating a climate where good ideas will be useful to as many people as possible. That's the ultimate kind of social goal. And so what I'm trying to say is that when we lock up our ideas, when we kind of fortify them against the world because someone might steal them, we pay as a society a kind of innovation tax. And by not allowing those ideas to get out and to connect with other ideas, by not allowing people to build on other people's ideas, a lot of the kind of creative energy, the generative kind of capabilities that we've been talking about this hour just have a much harder time happening because they don't do well with borders and barricades and walls. So it's not that we want to get rid of intellectual property law altogether. In fact, patents were originally created in part to disclose the inventions, so that people would be encouraged to share, and they would be protected but encouraged to share so that other people could learn from their insights. But I think that kind of the pendulum is kind of swung too far, and we want to make sure that we encourage open environments, which is not it's not a battle with commercial interests in the marketplace. I mean, the internet and the web, think of all the vast fortunes that have been made thanks to this open platform that nobody owns. So the two models can live together in productive ways. It's not a zero-sum kind of battle between them.
You did find, though, a greater degree of innovation in environments like universities and nonprofits, where the goal is typically not about individual enrichment.
That's in the last chapter of the book. I was a little bit worried. This book tells a lot of stories, and I wanted it to do that in part because that makes it fun to read and fun to write, frankly. But I wanted to make sure that people didn't feel like I was just cherry-picking anecdotes of stories of openness and connection when there were a million other things that ran counter to that thesis, right? And so in the last chapter, I kind of zoomed out and I looked at 300 kind of world-changing innovations from science and technology over the last really since Gutenberg, and tried to figure out how many of them came out of open environments like amateur scientists in the Enlightenment or the university system or open source kind of software models and things like that versus how many came out of closed market-driven, you know, entrepreneurs and or big corporations. And as you said, it turned out that even in the modern age, while there's a tremendous amount of innovation that comes out of the marketplace and it's a lot of things that we love about modern life come from that, there are more big ideas that come out of that open environment than the market environment. And often what happens is it's the underlying concept comes from, say, university research. And then it ends up becoming a platform that commercial interests can make a lot of money off of. So there are a lot of kind of research into, you know, think about genomics. There's going to be a massive amount of money made from the genomics revolution by big pharma in the coming years. But a lot of the core insights about understanding sequencing, decoding DNA came out of universities. And so, again, you know, when it works right, you can create in that open environment a whole range of new ideas that allow entrepreneurs and businesses and big companies to make money off them. But you have to keep both those systems working for the totality of it to work well.
Have you deliberately amended your work process at all as a result of having done this research?
Well, in some ways, the research, they've been co-evolving over the time, right? One thing I do, which is that I have this one document that I've been keeping for 6 years, which I call my Sparks file. And for a while, it was just a Microsoft Word document. Now it's a Google document, so I can get to it from anywhere. And it's one document where I write down every little fragment of an idea that I have for a book or a magazine article or a speech or a startup or whatever it is. And I keep it all there. I don't organize it at all. I don't put things into folders and things like that, because once you put things into folders, you don't have the kind of things get siloed off and you don't see them. But people do this, but the big thing that I do is I go back and I reread this entire document every 3 or 4 months. And because what I end up finding is that there's some idea, some little tiny hunch that I had 4 or 5 years ago that made no sense in 2007, but suddenly in 2010, because of some change in the world or my own life or someone I know, it's meaningful. And by revisiting those things, you actually bring those hunches alive.
Stephen Johnson's new book is called Where Good Ideas Come From, The Natural History of Innovation. Stephen, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great to be back.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.